Hello and welcome to Beyond the Filter, a podcast about censorship. My name's Jeremy.
And my name's Brandy. And today we have two special guests with us. Shambawi, who works for ILGA Asia, the Asian region of International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans and Intersex Association, who is joining us from Nepal. Welcome, Shambawi.
Thank you, Brandy. Thank you, Jeremy.
And we also have Mar Diaz joining us from Spain. Mar is a digital rights and LGBTQ advocate with a background in law and privacy consulting. Welcome, Mar.
Hi, thank you. So excited to be here today.
Mar and Shambawi are both going to be participating in the upcoming workshop that the Center of Online Safety and Liberty is organizing at RightsCon 2026. RightsCon is a leading summit on human rights in the digital age, and it is being held in Zambia this May. So we'll be talking a bit more about that later too.
But our larger topic of discussion today is how measures that both governments and platforms are taking across Europe and Asia are silencing LGBTQ plus communities, as well as allied communities such as sex workers and even women's health educators. Mar, turning to you first, we're seeing both governments and platforms claim that they're protecting users, but many marginalized communities feel more surveilled and censored than protected. So what's going on?
Yes, you're pointing to a real tension. Safety policies are expanding everywhere. It's not just Europe, Asia, it's the whole world. And it's at the same time as marginalized groups report feeling more watched, flagged, silenced. And this just become, in general, safety. Broad political justification in this sort of warlike narrative with, you know, Department of Defense in the US now being Department of War. We know of Palestinian genocide and Ukraine, Russia. There's this ongoing feeling that everyone is in danger and safety has become this keyword that justifies anything, mainly, well, censorship. You know, there's activists that are misclassified as extremism. Mostly LGBTQ content is flagged as adult or harmful, and political dissent is just treated as destabilizing. So this leads to platforms over-moderating to reduce risk and surveillance expands. This is quite a complex topic, I think, but I would say those are three high-level points, just security being justified to ongoing morale to pressure against our communities.
Turning to you, Shambawi, how are indirect laws instrumentalized against LGBTIQ expressions within the Asia region? And how are you responding to that with your work with ILGA Asia?
Thank you, Brandy. I think the low-hanging fruit of censorship is one of the most invoked laws. But we are also seeing a lot of laws that have been existing since the colonial era, especially in former British colonies like Malaysia, Singapore, India, Sri Lanka, where the ban on same-sex relationships and the criminalization of same-sex sexual relationships was there as like a British penal code. Going from that, we are in the current times, a lot of these impositions have been taken down and a lot of them still have not. So what brings us is to this balance act of countries where same-sex sexual relationships are still criminalized, but people still can express themselves freely online as long as they use anonymity as their protection. Whereas on the other hand, there is a way of platform takedowns and social media content themselves being policed and police themselves using entrapment in dating apps, especially as seen in like Iraq, Saudi Arabia, more around the Middle Eastern side of Asia, where we can see like the police make fake accounts and queer dating apps to entrap queer people as a way to arrest them. But when we look at it in terms of censorship, this leads to people self-censoring themselves and trying to hide themselves online. And on the other hand, safety conversations around real ID are creating greater threats for people who live in these criminalized areas, whereas the same anonymity is used against queer people in other reasons. And I think you also had a wonderful episode about China, where you comprehensively talked about how such laws were used to police online expression.
Thank you so much.
So that's really interesting that you mentioned the colonial background of some of these laws and the fact that even though they may have changed, that background sort of still exists there, maybe influencing the way that laws are still developing across Asia. So I wanted you to speak maybe a bit more about how regional coalitions, including ILGA Asia, have documented state actions that shrink civic spaces for LGBTIQ communities. For example, responses to raids and enforcement actions framed around morality or public order that disproportionately impact gender diverse and queer individuals. How do you see these patterns shaping legal repression, both offline and online?
Thank you. I think one way we can look about censorship, it is about repression of narratives. So censorship is mostly about narrative control as well as invisibilization of certain kind of narratives. ILGA Asia works with over 200 member organizations across the region who primarily work on LGBTIQ issues, and it covers a wide range of work. A lot of our member organizations have faced shadow banning of their posts. They have faced direct actions by the government and have been called in for police questioning for speaking out online. And a lot of the times we work upon member requests, and we try to bring these narratives forward in our work, whether it's to amplify their voices or use our voice to platform the issues that they cannot do so for safety and security reasons. A lot of our advocacy work also goes working with UN mechanisms in Geneva and New York, mostly around the Human Rights Council and the Sustainable Development Goals. We use these mechanisms to bring the experiences of the activists working on the ground to the global level and turn it into a policy discussion beyond just a human rights perspective, but also as a development perspective, and how LGBTIQ activists are facing a unique form of repression and invisibilization so that we can pressure the nation states using these international human rights mechanisms to do something about it. Even recently, we had our members speak in the Human Rights Council that is currently happening in Geneva.
Turning back to you, Ma, you're convening a roundtable on shadow banning and deplatforming at RightsCon. Tell us a bit about that and about the patterns you're seeing across Europe and the global south.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of overlapping on what Shambawi was just saying a minute ago, how platform and content moderation has been tailored to serve an ongoing narrative that is meant to serve security and control that leads to little transparency. Most of the queer communities and sex workers who are experiencing censorship lack the ability to know what's the reasoning why they're being censored, to lead to, as she was just saying, self-censorship and algo speak also being a big problem. I think I should take a step back and just explain a little bit about our proposal in the roundtable. What we aim to do here is to bring together different communities, especially of sex workers, who are experiencing shadow banning. Shadow banning being this specific type of censorship that means reducing your virality, and try to find the strategies to overcome it. So yes, I think our whole goal is to find ways to understand where these content moderation policies come from and provide nuanced context for them to be able to ensure safety online. Of course, we understand that can be a complex task, but not to the expense of the whole community being deplatformed.
How do sex workers and women's health educators' experience of platform moderation differ from mainstream creators?
That's a very good question. Sex workers and, in general, women's health educators often run in specific moderation patterns. They sometimes call it sexually exceptionalism, and it's content that it's legal, educational, safety-oriented, that is just treated as inherently risky just because it involves sex, bodies, reproductive health. Safety is usually a filler world that collapses when context is needed. So for mainstream creators, you know, it's often entertainment-oriented when they talk about sexual content, right? There may be a music video that is teasing or dating talk or fashion, and it's easy to be acceptable for commercial formats. It appeals to the male gaze, right? So even when they get flagged or there's content moderation against them, appeals often get resolved faster because their accounts are large, visible, but that's not the reality for most sex workers, you know, or even, as we were saying, women's health educators. When you use the words vagina, abortion, scored, condoms, or even harm reduction, these trigger content moderation systems, and things like educational diagrams or even clinical discussions can be flagged as explicit. So things as important as harm reduction advice, you know, screening clients, STI prevention, they tend to be mistaken for facilitating sex work that's leading to the account being removed or the content not being showed to the public. And this is a real problem because these whole communities cannot access to this vital information that they need to survive offline. You know, automated systems struggle to distinguish pornography and anatomy education, solicitation, and in general, labor rights discussion, adult content versus reproductive health information. This all collapses into just one category, and this leads to deplatforming.
So turning back to you, Shambhavi, one of the most terrifying things that I've heard from you was about how using dating apps is being used as a honeypot to find and prosecute LGBTIQ users. And I've actually worked a little in the trust and safety field, and I heard from the trust and safety people at Grindr that one thing that they do to try and safeguard their users against this is that they'll allow you to change the app icon so that it looks like a calculator or a notepad or something like that, just so that if the user's phone is seized, it won't be immediately apparent that they even have that app on there because it could cause a physical threat to their safety. So I have a question for both of you about this feedback loop between state regulation and platform moderation, where one can overcorrect in response to the other. So how does that affect marginalized communities? And Shambhavi, I'd ask you to answer first.
Thank you, Jeremy. And I think we are also in constant conversations with platforms on how we can improve safety. But one of the main issues in the countries I've mentioned that our research has shown is that the police themselves pose as a fellow queer person using the app as a user. And when they make appointments to meet in person, that is when the raids happen. And it is very difficult to solve these kind of issues with simply platform regulation. It needs a deeper social change. And when we talk about this kind of policy or social behavior changes, and when we look at the feedback loop between state regulation and platform moderation, as you asked, I think the conversation should also include which countries or which states actually have the negotiating power with the states to have these conversations and to push back against any content moderation rules, whether or not those rules fall on the side of human rights or against human rights themselves. For example, a recent example from my country, Nepal itself, is when the state asked, in an attempt for a broader censorship control, if we are being honest, for the international platforms to register a local office in Nepal, the platforms denied because Nepal is not a big enough market. But that kind of snowballed into a social media ban that led to a series of protests. And now we are back looking at how we can update our cybersecurity laws and ID bill in the market that we have, that these platforms do not need to comply because their business is big enough. In the same way, when we talk about the phenomenon of cybersecurity and disinformation, and especially around disinformation, there is a lot of state regulation happening in these kind of new fake news laws, which seek to regulate the social media content itself. And a lot of these laws from the states, because they know they cannot directly affect the platform, they're trying to regulate user behavior instead, which further marginalizes the marginalized people because they are the ones who are most affected and they are the ones who are more likely to use dissenting ideas and put dissenting posts against the state in these platforms themselves.
That was so interesting. Would love to learn more about the situation in Nepal specifically, but overall, state regulation and platform moderation are tightly linked, right? Because platforms don't moderate in a vacuum. They try to moderate in sort of an anticipation of legal risk or political pressure, but mostly, as you were saying, is market access, right? They have incentives, mostly it's economic. Law shapes part of platform incentives, but that's not the whole picture, right? When governments adopt broad online safety or morality laws, then platforms will face fines or criminal liability exposure. But then where a law does not explicitly target LGBTQ content, there's vague terms like harmful to minors, public morality, propaganda, family values, that leads to this sort of legal uncertainty that platform just reduce with over moderation, right? They just want to reduce exposure. So to be able to keep on having great markets to sell products to, they just choose to have broad automatic filtering. I feel like what it's common to be seen is moderation at a scale just relies on automated keyword filters or image classifiers, risk scaling models that just end up collapsing in this overall shadow banning and demonetization and removal of information, age gating of LGBT content and suppression in general.
So this over-moderation that platforms just do by default, I wanted to ask you if there's some additional tools in the European context to push back against that and to hold the platforms to account for doing that. In particular, I'm thinking about the DSA, the Digital Services Act, which did introduce some transparency tools and appeal mechanisms, at least for the very large online platforms. So are marginalized communities actually able to use these mechanisms to push back against over-censorship and shadow banning?
Well, short answer, sometimes, but unevenly and with real barriers. The DSA, it's meant to require that very large online platforms like Meta, TikTok, YouTube, to provide clear statements of the reasons why the content was removed. And it must offer an internal complaint handling system so that there can be an internal way to dispute, or if not able to resolve, to enable access to a certified out-of-court dispute settlement body. So these all needs to be polished by transparency reports and yada, yada, yada. Now, that's the theory, but reality is that capacity is unequal. There is a lot of work to do in the effectiveness of this regulation because, first of all, language is usually not accessible. Myself, a lawyer, when I look into the DSA reports, I really struggle to understand what they're saying. There's a lot of legal literacy and, of course, also time and emotional labor once you're trying to talk about something that is sensitive to you, that it's important for your community. Once you're fully banned, it's really hard to even find in the first place this sort of resource. Most of the people that I talk to don't even know that you have an internal appealing system when your post on Instagram was shadow banned or removed. And for this whole statement of reasons that it's meant to increase transparency, yes, of course, we have more documentation about it, but that doesn't mean clarity. It often shows this sort of template-based explanations with very broad categories like sexual content, hate speech, that it's not fully explained. So you're back to the first place when you wanted to appeal the whole issue that you're facing because of content moderation, right? So when it comes to transparency and in dispute bodies, I would say ineffective. And when we look into the out-of-court dispute bodies, they're useful but just underused. Many users don't know these bodies exist, first of all. Secondly, processes tend to be super slow. Then decisions do not address systemic bias. They only look into individual cases. And there is also language and cost barriers to these. So yeah, I think that even where the places where we have regulations that are thought to protect us from these harms, which I know we are very privileged compared to other regions, still, we are far from being ideal.
Another question for both of you. Many of the communities most affected by shadow banning and digital repression are in the global south. How do we ensure that regulatory debates in Brussels or Geneva don't become Eurocentric templates imposed elsewhere?
Sure. I think this kind of draws back to the earlier conversation we had about how colonial laws are still impacting a lot of Asian countries, and we do not want another form of neocolonialism, definitely. But I think a lot of regulatory debates that are taking place in Europe, per se, do have a human rights basis. And when we try to bring these to a global South context, I think the more than the specifics, the legal and rights-based arguments are the one that can be imported easier because a lot of these platforms that we are seeking to regulate themselves come from a very Western-centric models, and their business models that they are operating in, our reasons are also very Western-centric, for lack of a better word. So when we think of regulating these models, another conversation we need to have is also how we are regulating them on a rights basis. So with the advent of new technology, the laws themselves do not get outdated easily. A lot of the cybersecurity laws that are, there's a lot of Asian countries which have cybersecurity laws currently in the parliament, for example, Malaysia, Philippines, which are seeking to take away laws from like late 90s or early 2000s, mostly media and broadcasting laws, which have been used in the internet context, and they do not translate well as the technology has shifted. So what we are trying to influence right now is looking at these in the core ideas of privacy, freedom, safety. How do we ensure privacy, whether it we are talking about social media, whether we are talking about generative AI, whether we are talking about any new form of technology that will emerge in the future days. The core idea for regulation should be any technology should not go against the rights of the people. And if we bring the regulatory frameworks that are being discussed and we try to influence the conversations about regulation on the basis of human rights, on the basis of basic safety for the people, and that is coming from like user perspective, but also from a social and individual perspective, I think they will be more effective in terms of not just sustainability, but also in ensuring that it is widely used.
Mar, would you like to address that question as well? Because I know the effect of Eurocentric regulation on Global South users has also been a concern for you.
Yeah, no, I'm honestly 100% with everything that Shimbawi said. It's hard to add on that because you did a really good walkthrough high-level points. I think focusing on human rights to approach the world, it's just the best approach we can have to it. I will say on top of that, that when it comes to algorithmic discrimination and automated decision making, one issue that we keep on flagging is how context is always lost. So for this end, and to be able to ensure that diverse voices are heard, we need the algorithms, if we're going to keep on using them, to be trained not only by white male voices on the internet, but for the rest of the world to also have a space first, and for that a space to be used to drive the context of the conversations that we are going to have. Of course, sex is read into very different lines and it's understood in very different ways. The same way privacy is, the same way as even the way we understand our meals, right? Everything requires an understanding of your cultural and historic nuances for it to have a proper conversation. So I think on top of approaching it from a human lens perspective, we need to have a diverse approach and have into the room that is making decisions, not only the white Western views, but other people in the room.
Ma, your work also tries to center sex workers' voices as authorities in these debates. Why is that important?
Well, here, I'm going to try to point to some fantastic work that ESWA has done. I highly encourage everyone to look into the ESWA's report that we're producing, I think, April last year, on how sex workers belong on social media. Sex workers, they always tell me not to use this expression, but being the canary in the coal mine maybe is a better one. The communities that are usually first affected by content moderation. You know, the morality of society tends to look into sex work as something that is negative. So it's quite easy for the world to look into the decisions that are made against sex workers as something that it's okay. You know, remember SESTA and FOSTA, or all of the laws that are meant to protect minors, are literally the origin of all of the discrimination that we are facing in the rest of communities afterwards. So they are literally authorities because they are the ones who have been experiencing this for the longest and have been fighting it. I would highly, highly recommend looking into not only the ESWA reports that are very insightful, but also into the Freedom of the Net, of Freedom House report. There's this fantastic group called Reaper Uncensored, who also has a lot of research about how sex workers have been the first one to fight against censorship. I should have explained ESWA stands for the European Sex Workers Alliance. And yeah, in general, looking into sex workers as not only workers themselves, of course, but as experts who have been struggling with these issues for the longest and who we should look into as authorities.
I really loved your point there about how society kind of turns a blind eye to the censorship of sex work because it's morally stigmatized anyway. And so nobody really wants to stand up and defend it. And that becomes even more true when you're talking about particular, you know, more edgy practices within sex work. The example that springs to mind right now, because it's happening right now, is the United Kingdom is planning to put a ban on incest-themed pornography. And nobody wants to stand up in defense of that because it seems like you support real incest if you're going to support, you know, fictional incest. And it's just something that nobody wants to be seen as doing. But the problem is, if you don't, then of course it's going to expand to other forms of online sex work and, you know, other sensitive themes. So this ties right into our Drawing the Line workshop that we'll be holding at RightsCon, where we're asking whether expanding criminal frameworks to cover fictional or AI-generated content or performance, you know, like online sex work, whether that risks undermining victim-centered justice and freedom of expression. I'd like to ask both of you your thoughts on this. Shambhavi, maybe you first. What thoughts do you have on the expansion of criminal frameworks to cover fictional content and how that does risk maybe undermining victims and the speech of all of us?
Thank you, Jeremy, for the question and for bringing this issue up, because I think it is a very timely issue. I think another example that is even more recent is yesterday Malaysia had an announcement where the Malaysian government asked media and broadcasting platforms, as well as the local people talking about LGBTIQ people as deviant culture instead of using LGBT or the Malay language equivalent of the word, to protect children from looking up what LGBT means and to prevent normalization of LGBT culture. And I think, as you said, with incest, is like for them, incest is something to ban. And if people look up incest and they read incest-themed topics, it will normalize incest. So we need to protect people from normalizing incest. And it is coming from a very protectionist lens. But I think that is where sex education should step in, not censorship. If you think a teen somewhere is learning and setting their expectations of what sex is from like a BL or a GL, which is like boys love or girls love fiction on AO3, or an incest-themed novel, then we need to look where we have failed as a society to explain how relationships work and who steps in to take the burden. The government, like the protection, should not be an imposition of what people think is best, what the people in power think is best for the society. Regulations are not a place for morality. We need to look at it from a very clear basis. And when it is very difficult to draw the lines around this online, mostly because of the depth of curated spaces. When we were growing up with the internet, and it does make us feel like old people sometimes, we had like specific, everything was not social media. We had specific places for having niche discussions for people with different kind of fetishes or different kind of curiosities to look up information. And we had tags and content geared towards specific audiences instead of having these umbrella monopoly social media platforms, which is accessible to everyone. And it is not saying in terms of like gatekeeping people from a certain type of space, but whenever I'm looking at, for example, my Facebook or Twitter or X timeline, it is not niche or it is not geared towards a specific topic. As you would say, the blogs, which were a lot common used in early 2010s, were. And these shifting ways of how internet is working is also shifting the ways the state is trying to respond in making regulations. And this recent bans around the different kinds of expressions, especially queer expressions, against expressions where adults can fantasize and for a more common terms in this niche space, so be self-indulgent about something that would not condone in real life, But sometimes it is okay to read about problematic things in fiction, the problematic being in double quotes. So I think one of the ways we need to think is like how we can redefine the internet in a way that we can treat adults who are using the internet as adults, and we can like make education and awareness more accessible in a way, and have like digital literacy also include a part about where the user themselves have agency in choosing what kind of the content they engage in, and where they can reach that content and have proper use of tags and filters to find the content they want to engage in, instead of having like an overarching state-imposed morality umbrella.
I really couldn't agree with you more there. So Ma, do you have any thoughts that you might be sharing at the workshop in May about the consequences of extending criminal frameworks to cover fictional or fantasy content?
I mean, it is not only heartbreaking, but also shocking to see how derailed conversations have gone when we talk about harm. Trying to, as Jeremy was saying, right, no one wants to be the person that stands against loss prevention incest, right? Of course, it sounds a little bit edgy, but of course, because once again, this conversation is decontextualized. When we try to overcompensate with regulatory pathways to address abuse, we don't need to just make the CSAM definition higher. We don't need to look into new ways of prohibiting practices that we know that are already bad. We've been existing for long enough in humanity to know what things are bad. I think that's something that should be sort of obvious. There's this tendency to overlook into legislation as the perfect solution, whereas, as Shambhavi was saying, the work doesn't need to be done through an imposition of a law, but rather through education, actual enforcement of community standards to look into what we can do better as humanity, as a society, where we're failing to find ourselves in situations where the reality of the harm that we're thinking is happening, instead of a hypothetical, negligent or problematic situation that we would be standing for. It's, of course, the limits of this are ridiculous. We are not going to prohibit movies of dystopias just because they find a lot of violence in them. Why would we looking to sex to do the same thing? I think that our regulatory framework has already the resources we need to fight the actual harms that we want to protect us from. But looking into legislation just as a way to overcompensate, it's a problem and not a solution.
I mean, again, I couldn't agree more with that. The fact that it's assumed that talking about stigmatized topics is going to make them acceptable in real life, it just doesn't make sense to me. In February this year, in Australia, a woman was convicted of a child abuse crime for writing a fictional book about two adult characters engaged in BDSM role play, age play specifically. So everyone knows. I mean, I'm sure that nobody who would read that sort of book would be in favor of child abuse. And yet the author was convicted of that very crime just for writing a fictional book. It blows my mind. So I'm just wondering if either of you, and Shambhavi maybe, do you have any examples of works that have been classified under obscenity or morality laws in Asia for their fictional or artistic content?
I think one example that comes to mind is the recent series of crackdowns in China. And you also did a very comprehensive episode about it and how, like, in Anzhou province specifically, the government cracked down on a lot of authors, many of whom were young women straight out of high school or college, who were writing queer fiction stories. And once there was a question of monetization or possible monetization of those stories, the government cracked down when it was just looking away from a website that was operating for years. But apart from that, I don't think of any published fiction, but there has been a lot of crackdowns on social media content for a lot of queer and fictional and artistic works, especially around Malaysia recently. It has gotten very strict, and they are also planning to classify all LGBTIQ content as problematic. Interestingly, they have also done raids against programs that are seeking to do HIV awareness or writing workshops for queer people focused, but not on the fiction themselves. But the way the trend is shifting, policy-wise, and with the broadened concept of obscenity and morality. And in a lot of countries, we have noticed, for example, in Nepal itself and Philippines, the punishment and criminal liability in terms of the sentence served as well as fines is higher for obscenity laws for online publication, even more than real-life sexual harassment. And I think that stems from the idea of both misogyny as well as like control. And if there are more examples like the one you stated in Australia, and if that is the trend we are seeing, I think we need to be careful about how we engage with these kind of laws.
Ma, when regulators say that they are protecting children or protecting users, how do we ensure that protection doesn't become overreach, especially when no real victim is involved? That's at the heart of the Drawing the Line workshop. How do your own experiences inform that debate?
Right. Thank you for the question, because this is a fantastic one. When we try to approach regulation, we must do it from a perspective of nuance. And this means to be focusing on the actual issue that we're trying to protect against finding over general and complex conversations to be leading to, as you were saying, prohibiting general practices that affect more than the actual victims. Another a good example, right, is one of the conversations that we were having, how loosening the definition of CSAM leads to censorship. When we were talking about deepfakes and how deepfakes wants to be prohibited, we probably will lead into general issues like the case Jeremy was saying earlier, right? This woman who astonishingly was charged for a crime of doing something hypothetical. But we already have the tools to fight against this, as many biometric legislations fight. Deepfakes are prohibited for biometric processing, not only under the GDPR, but maybe we can look into other legislations like BIPA in Illinois. We can also look into China legislations or even Brazil. Thinking that deepfakes are something that are unregulated is just trying to, again, force legislation where we actually need more education, where deepfakes includes someone's face, body, movements, voice, in a way that allows them to identify them. It's a personal data that already is regulated, and as long as they are identifiable, we know that these requires a specific ways of processing in a ways that requires already a way of requiring consent. That's something that is usually lacking here in the conversations that we're looking, and that already has a way of punishing for this crime.
Thank you for bringing that up, Mara. I mean, that's moving towards solutions. Like, you're talking about real solutions here, because the deepfakes are a real problem, and it's not just the same as, you know, fictional fantasy, because even if they're generated by AI, there's a real victim being depicted there and there's real harm being done. And so a lot of policymakers and activists who are trying to expand the definition of CSAM or child sexual abuse material are using deepfakes as the justification. This is something that UNESCO has recently recommended that countries should do. They should expand the definition to include all generated material, whether depicts a real victim or not. So thank you for pointing out that that's not the only solution to this problem, and maybe not the best solution to this problem, that we can actually target deepfake abuse in a more direct way. Shambhavi, do you have any solutions that come to mind when you think about deepfake abuse? And how are LGBTQ plus users in Asia affected by the issue of deepfakes?
I think one of the most seen issues with deepfakes is over-sexualization of people, especially when queer folks are already sexualized, and content depicting queer people, whether or not in a sexual setting, is always already marked as like adult specific, and as Mard mentioned, at a higher risk of being shadow banned by platforms. When these people's faces are used against them, it is a lot of sexualization, a lot of misinformation, and seen to like reflect against the community when, like, let me roll back a bit. It's like when their images are taken and create a deepfakes out of, whether or not in sexual context they are being used to further demonize the community as a whole and used to push narrative against them about how LGBTIQ people are a quote-unquote blight to the society, or how they are against our family values, or how they are destroying the society. And it is a lot of narrative warfare going on. And when these victimless crimes cannot again be taken out of context, because sometimes their images are not taken of any specific person, but these generated images are used to spread a hateful message against the entire community and can amount to hate speech itself. So I think, like reiterating what Mar has been saying, these cases should be taken on a case-to-case basis. And just because there is no direct victims does not mean there isn't a community affected by these speeches or these kind of images or these kind of media. But on the other hand, using it as like a pitchfork against entire technology or the use of any kind of generative content that depicts queer people at all is again like putting the cart before the horse kind of situation.
So let's talk about pushing back against this movement towards over-censorship, shadow banning, surveillance. What can we do? What cross-sector solutions can we come up with to try and push back against this? How can we build meaningful coalitions that could actually work in this context? Maybe activists, tech founders, lawyers, marketers, policymakers. Do either of you have any thoughts to share on that?
I think for cross-sector solutions, I can talk about an initiative that we are working on with the OHCHR, where we are working directly with advertisers who are one of the reasons these platforms do continue to exist and can monetize content. So what we are doing is like taking examples of where there is advertisement against a clearly misinformed or a hate post or a post that does not align with the values of the advertiser themselves that are being used by the platform. And we are working with advertisers to ask for accountability from the platforms in the sense of like what kind of content is being paid, like what kind of content is being showed with the advertiser's brand in terms of branding and marketing to push an economic narrative. But apart from that, when we are looking at from a cross-sector perspective, I think a lot of these kind of issues that we are talking about are backsliding a lot, and especially for the human rights and CSO sectors, civil society organizations, like the ones we work with a lot. They're facing funding cuts, they're working in reduced capacities, and they are also against an information war from conservative forces. And in this conservative narratives, in these kind of situations, one of the ways is to like how we can ensure that if LGBTIQ voices are silenced, how can we work with maybe the labor movements, with the women's rights movement, with the tech movements to have their voices in intersecting issues, because the society does not exist in a vacuum. So if one movement is being silenced, how we can work with other movements to keep the messaging going, and a way of civil society cross-sector movement, where another way is doing an economic argument like the one I mentioned before. And the economic argument has been seen as very effective in other forms of LGBTIQ activism. For example, in Thailand and in Taiwan, one of the biggest factors that allowed for same-sex marriage to be legalized is like communicating to the states and the legislators that it would bring a lot of tourism into the country, especially in terms of pink tourism from LGBTIQ people seeking to get married there. So how can we find similar economic arguments that can convince either the platforms or the states themselves to take progressive legislations?
Those are fantastic points. What do each of you hope that policymakers will take away from RightsCod when it comes to LGBTQI expression and censorship?
I think a fantastic outcome of RightsCon would be if we were able to at least make understand those who are drafting policy and enforcing content moderation that the decisions that they're making are causing an actual harm, and that this harm should be repaired. For them to understand all of those nuances and for them to be open to hearing other voices, I highly agree with how we need to find cross-sector alignment to learn how other communities are fighting back so that we can reincorporate and share with others, because narrative alignment is strategic. It's not cosmetic. We need these coalitions to have a shared narrative frame and help fight against each other. And once we are together working to show all of these harms for all of people working in content moderation, to be able to see all of these issues, at least for them to identify what are the patterns that are failing when it comes to content moderation. That would be, for me, at least, would be a fantastic outcome.
Well, that brings us to the end, not only of this episode of Beyond the Filter, but it also caps off our first season of monthly episodes. We'll be taking a little break for a while, but we will be back, so stay tuned. Meanwhile, it's not too late to register for RightsCon, where you can hear me and Mar and Shambawi, along with some other special guests, discussing these topics in more depth. So do go ahead and check out rightscon.org for more information.
Thank you both for joining us today. And thanks to everyone listening to Beyond the Filter throughout the year. We really appreciate your interest and support.
Thank you so much for inviting. This was a pleasure and a great conversation.
Yes, thank you so much.
Bye, but just for now.
Bye-bye for now.